Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour. It is November 10th, 2016. A couple topics tonight on Saturn, on the hexagon pattern. I'll be talking a little bit about that again. It's changed colors, but also about its structure. I posted a picture on my webpage, Pictures of the Day, and I'm sorry, the Pictures of the Day had not been updated for quite a while, actually about 2 months. And so I apologize for that, but I'm just one person. And I do this myself for a very good reason. It's really difficult to transmit this kind of information to somebody else. So when things don't get done, that means, well, I'm busy on other things and I have, like anybody, prioritized tasks. But there's a good picture there of the hexagonal pattern at Saturn's one of Saturn's poles. In fact, both of the poles of Saturn have this physical structure, and I'll be talking a bit about that. Fracking in Oklahoma causing earthquakes. You know, I grew up in the United States. I don't remember Oklahoma having problems with earthquakes, and I bet the people in Oklahoma don't remember that either. But with fracking, which is taking a liquid slurry and pumping it down into the ground to force oil and natural gas so it can be removed and extracted, does two things. It readjusts the structure down there, puts a lot of pressure where there was not pressure before. Secondly, it greatly pollutes the water table. Now, these are two horrendously horrible results of this activity. And here's a somewhat of a fun fact. A quart of oil, like you go to the gas station, you get a quart of oil, put in your car. If you put that in a water table, it would pollute 1,000 gallons of water. That's the pollution rate of something chemical like that. And that's to certain designated limits. The reality is there are other pollutants which accumulate in your body, like if you put benzene or some other chemical solvent in water, or if you put, say, mercury, for example, it would be something that would accumulate. So if, say, you have a well and you have farm activity and this is going down into the water table and you're drinking this without filtration, then these chemicals accumulate in your body over time. And so you're slowly poisoning yourself. Other naturally occurring poisons in the water, one of the biggest ones is arsenic. I've talked about this before in my show, but fracking is just pumping tremendous amounts of polluted water down into the ground. Another technology that depends on this type of activity is lithium. The lithium battery in your phones and your tablet and all of the devices that today your cars, the electric cars that are being produced, all use lithium. That might be replaced sometime in the future, but those new technologies take a while to come online and actually replace old technologies. But lithium is not a mineral like iron or something or copper where you dig it up in veins. Lithium is, you have to basically do a fracking type process to push it out and extract it from the ground. Once again, leaving the ground tremendously polluted. So a lot of the things we take for granted in modern technology really are horrible for the environment. So anyway, Oklahoma is, you know, receiving the financial benefit from the oil industry, etc., but there's a price. Earthquakes are becoming more frequent. You have Florida where the sinkhole problem is getting worse and worse. there are more and more houses in Florida that are succumbing to sinkholes or sinkhole activity where a floor or a corner of the house just drops out, sinks down, and they have to come in. And there's a method of fixing these. You have to pump cement, or let me tell you one of the techniques. You come in with a big machine, you drill sideways, and then you drill vertically downwards. It could be 50 or 100 feet until you hit something solid, typically calcium carbonate stone of some type or salt bed or whatever. And then you pour, you have a column that you fill with cement, and then this supports the house. You put horizontal braces, and you basically float the house on these cement pillars, and this is a very costly process, of course. In the meantime, the house has gone to 50% or less of its value. No fault of the owner of the house. It's not an upkeep issue. It's just, a random thing. And now there are zones. The whole northwestern region of Florida is subject to sinkholes. So once again, and then, of course, the big pollution event where a company, a fertilizer company recently, or not recently, for many decades, had been pouring nuclear waste, including radioactive waste, into basically a holding pond. The holding pond, the side of it breached and into a sinkhole and polluted a vast amount of underground water in Florida. So these man-made events. Now, let me tell you something else that is causing this in Florida. Tampa Bay and the bigger cities are drawing water for the housing, which is a lot of housing in Florida, over in western Florida and then down around Tampa. Tampa is a major city. They're drawing water in, especially from the region north of there, and by extracting water from the aquifer, then there's less strength in the sand, because Florida is basically sand sitting on limestone, and this is causing a lot more sinkholes in that region of Tampa and north of Tampa. And the people there are basically losing their houses and losing the value in their houses because the people in Tampa need water. All of these underground water issues are basically coming to a head. And I've often said, if Florida ever experienced an earthquake, it would be devastating, for a lot more houses would develop sinkhole activity, because that shaking is going to, any small pockets that are underground would cause the dry sand above to just fall down. And so a lot of houses are sitting in Florida above sinkholes that have not breached yet. What happens is, just imagine you're at the beach and you're walking along the beach where the water comes up. The water comes up to a certain area and then the waves, and then goes back down. You can walk on that sand. It's hard. It's just like cement. You can drive a car on it. You could ride a horse on it. But if you go up above there where the dry sand is, you can hardly walk in it. Your feet are sinking down in the sand. It's very difficult to walk in. So the point is that the same thing happens with underground water. If there's water, then sand becomes bound up, and it's very hard. It's durable. But if you take that water out of there, all of a sudden the sand becomes like an hourglass. And also the thing that happens is the limestone or salt bed or whatever is under there can leach away also, providing a hole. So eventually, if things start sinking in, there's probably tens of thousands, they're not probably, there are. There's tens of thousands of houses in Florida that have sinkholes underneath them that have not fallen in yet. And these could happen in the future. But like I say, if there were ever an earthquake, Florida would just, it would shake Florida, and all those small pockets would start to fall. The sand above them would start to fall in, and that would be like an hourglass. It would just cascade up to the surface. And so not, it would be a terrible, devastating event for Florida if there were ever an earthquake or something that could shake it just a little bit. Okay, so that's the good news for the evening. I'm going to talk a little bit about Saturn, Saturn's hexagonal spot. If you look at the picture I posted on my homepage, just scroll down to the center column, Pictures of the Day, and you will see the hexagonal pattern at the pole of Saturn. The cause of this, I have a theoretical concept for what's causing it, but in the picture you can see cyclonic storms. And let me just pull this up so I'm looking at it while I'm talking here. And, of course, the website, jmccsci.com, seven letters, jmccsci.com. Scroll down until you see the picture of the day right in the center of your screen. And, okay, let's start from the center out. The very center is the very southern pole of Saturn. And remember, Saturn is a gas planet, a gas atmosphere. And so the solid portion is way down deep. And so the cyclonic storms do not interact with the surface on Earth. I'll talk about comparing this to Earth. But on Earth, the cyclonic storms, which we call hurricanes, come across the Atlantic. And when they hit the shore, the whether it's an island or whether it's a shore of Florida, say, for example, or it comes around through the Gulf and hits the Gulf of Mexico shore, the storm shorts out electrically. Now, remember that the standard concept for what causes hurricanes is that they're formed from warm water. Totally ridiculous idea that can be proven by third-grade logic, not the least of which is Mars has hurricanes. And there's no warm water, there's nothing on Mars that would indicate oceans or warm water to form hurricanes. So anyway, the storms are fueled, they're created and maintained by an electrical current sheet. And the process for this I explain in my weather book, Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun-Earth Weather. But basically, in the electrical column, the ions are rushing up, and that's what causes the spinning activity. So right in the very center of the picture, you see a spiral pattern of a major hurricane that's directly at the South Pole, or this may be the North Pole. I'm not sure if this is the North or South Pole. Both poles of Saturn have hexagonal patterns like this. But right at the very center, you see this spiral pattern. And then out farther, you see a number right above the center, point. You see what looks like a hurricane. And then down below also, or what looks like the great red spot of Jupiter. And so these are moving around this central point at the very south pole of Saturn. Now, remember that Saturn is acting like a comet in the solar wind. So it has a continual influx of electrical current, and it comes down the magnetic field lines. And this is also what causes our auroras on planet Earth, is the magnetic field lines. If you take a bar magnet and you look at the magnetic field lines, they come out of the North Pole, wrap around, and come back down into the South Pole. And so the rule of thumb is that electrical charged particles, if they cross the magnetic field, they get deflected away. But if they come down the magnetic field lines into either the North or the South Pole, they follow the magnetic field lines, they don't bend, and they can attach directly down to the surface of the planet, which they do on planet Earth, and cause auroras. So auroras on Jupiter, on Saturn, are also very common. But you see them in a different spectrum of the electromagnetic spectrum. You see them in the ultraviolet. But here you can clearly see a number of cyclonic storms, hurricanes, you might call them, on Saturn. And these typically last for a long time. Like the Great Red Spot on Jupiter has been visible. It was actually observed, I believe, first by Galileo with his small telescope, handmade telescope. And it's been in existence ever since. On Earth, the hurricanes form in the Atlantic. When they make landfall, they literally short out electrically to the land. The electrical current from the ionosphere shorts out to the land and causes the hurricane to lose energy and drop its water. But that's not the case on Saturn or Jupiter, so the storms keep moving around and moving around, and they do pick up energy. They combine with other wind systems, and so they're dynamic. They do change. They're also associated in belts, counter-rotating belts, where one system will rotate in one direction and the other system will rotate in the other direction. So you see that with a number of months ago. Let me see if I'll pull that up and see where they are in the pictures of the day so you can take a look at these Jupiter pictures. Okay, so anyway, if you go to the July 28th and the July 13th, 2016 pictures of the day, just click on the link below the Saturn picture that you found. Just click on the link pictures of the day. It'll take you to the, excuse me. It'll take you to the pictures of the day subpage and go down to July 28th and July 13th. On the way down, stop also at September 1st, and you're going to see the pictures of two hurricanes. Now, these are hurricanes on Earth that were heading to Hawaii. And so it's interesting to see that there are belts of hurricanes that roll around the belts of Jupiter in succession. And so we see that very same phenomena here on Earth, where you see two hurricanes in succession moving off towards Hawaii. And then I also, during that time, September 1st, on that radio show, I would have been talking about, this is my regular weekly show, I would have been talking about how those hurricanes approaching Hawaii shorted out with the electrical connection from the vertical electric field that goes from the major volcano on the island of Hawaii called Mauna Loa up to the ionosphere, and how that robs the hurricane of its electrical current that's driving it as it comes across the Pacific Ocean. So anyway, check that out as explanation along with that. So that's September 1st, 2016 on the picture of the day subpage. And while you're at it, take a little time and peruse that picture of the day subpage. It's a lot of great information there. And then, so September 1st, July 28th, July 13th. Just scroll down and you'll see the pictures. But on the really best one of Jupiter is July 13th. And I've got one picture there that shows the various bands of Jupiter with, of course, the famous Great Red Spot. But in all of the bands of Jupiter, you can see the cyclonic storms. Now, if you look down at another picture just a little bit lower, you'll see many, many. In fact, it's a question or kind of a game of count the cyclonic storms. Just quickly, I see the Great Red Spot here. There's a white one underneath it to the left of that. There's another white one, and underneath those, there are many, many small cyclonic storms, basically hurricanes. But remember that they don't have a land mass underneath them. The land mass is very, very deep. And so the storms continue to rotate around the planet year after year after year. We've seen cyclonic storms on Jupiter combine. That's a very interesting process where they get too close and they actually combine. And what that really is happening is the electrical currents that are driving those snap together. It's called the pinch effect. It's when you have two powerful electric fields, they combine. And so that is what was happening in Hawaii. That's why there's no major hurricanes really that have ever hit the Big Island of Hawaii, because it's protected because the big volcano there, it's about what? I forget how many thousands of feet tall. Let me just pull up that statistic because I want to get that correct. It is just shy of about 14,000 feet. And so that's high enough. There's a lot of other islands that don't have that advantage. And so what happens, though, is that as the hurricanes approach, the electrical current from the hurricane gets pulled in by the electrical current that's coming off the top of the mountain, Mauna Loa, up to the ionosphere. And it basically robs all of the energy driving electrical current from the hurricane. And the hurricanes dissipate, which happened repeatedly. We've seen this. Okay, so anyway, back to Jupiter and Saturn. They do not have land masses or mountainous islands or anything like that in the path of these cyclonic storms. So they continue roaming around the planet, around and around and around in the atmosphere. Now, the other point I want to make is that in the opposite flowing wind belts, the storm systems pass by one another relatively unaffected. So that's very interesting. So this gives you an idea that the cyclonic storms, the hurricane-type storms on Saturn and Jupiter, are very much like the storms we experience on Earth. And, of course, with the exception that the gas planets, Jupiter, Saturn, do not have land masses. They're basically gas planets, so they don't have that land mass underneath to interact with the electrical current. Okay, so that's very interesting. So back to the picture of Saturn. The cause of the hexagonal shape is clearly related to electrical activity. And so that's something I'm working on in the background. And there's one thing that's also available today are photos in different wavelengths. So the photo you're seeing gets to look a lot deeper into the cloud structure than some of just like the regular visible light, where the haze, the upper cloud layer haze prevents you from seeing the structure down in. It's like a big cavern, as you can see, into the atmosphere of Saturn as it, that big cyclonic storm. So you have storms within storms within storms, basically. For those who are just listening, I encourage you to go to my webpage, and then you can also pick up the archive of this radio show and listen to it again, and then go and look at these pictures while you're listening to the lecture. Okay, so I'll be dealing with this issue of Saturn, its hexagonal patterns, and related atmospheric conditions. I'll be doing that again in the future. I just want to give a little bit of an update here on solar weather. Man, the sun has been quiet for a very, very long time. There's just nothing going on. I mean, there was a little flare that affected some auroras in the northern, very northern, polar regions, which is pretty much normal. But literally, the sun is just quiet as a church mouse, and it has been. And that's what it makes all the more comical that, remember, a number of weeks ago, even Obama was coming out and saying he actually signed a presidential directive or executive order for preparedness against solar storm activity that would damage the power grid. Now, I mean, and there was all kinds of hype going on at the time, like, oh, it's inevitable, we're all going to die. NASA was doing it. All the major space and space weather media were calling, crying wolf. But there was absolutely no reason for it. And so the sun continues to be totally quiescent, very calm. Calm as a kitten, and certainly no predictions of anything happening in the near future. It takes a number of days for solar storms to get to us, And typically you can see the visible signs of this happening. So clearly in the next few days at least, we're pretty safe from being bombarded by any type of major solar activity, and probably for a very long time to come. And what I was worried about is even the smallest little flare, or they'd even make something up and go, hey, the sun is, you know, has flares going on, or CMEs, whatever, and it's going to shut down the power grid. And I thought they were going to try and pull something like that to influence the election. Remember that, what was it, Hurricane Matthew, a very manipulated storm, came into Florida and rode up the eastern seaboard there and disrupted a lot of the pre-election activity in the United States. Apparently, it didn't have a tremendous effect when the vote final came on November 8th, but it was very clearly a manipulated storm to cause havoc in those areas. And it's hard to say. A lot of times those things can backfire. People have certain intentions or plans when they start messing with Mother Nature, and the end result is that it comes back to bite them. Changing topics a little bit here, November 14th, coming up in a few days, which is this coming Monday, there's going to be an extra-large full moon. Now, if you saw the one in October, I happened to be out at night on a clear night and saw the moon coming up over the hills in the distance. It was pretty remarkable. So anyway, November will be the same. And there's three this year. In fact, the next time this will happen will be like 2025 or something like that, they say. So anyway, go out, Monday night, watch the full moon, and the most dramatic time is when you see it coming up in the east, right around sunset. You see the sun going down, and around the same time, the sun's coming up. And it's interesting, if you have hills to the east, then the sky will be actually dark when it comes up, as opposed to if you have flat land to the east of you, then the moon will be coming up right around the same time as sunset. So anyway, if there's hills to the east, the sky will be dark, and I think it's a bit more dramatic. But anyway, this coming Monday, take a look at that. Go out and see the largest full moon that you'll see until the year 2025. And this is because the moon is simply closer in its orbit at that time, at the time when the moon is full. So those are two cycles. Of course, the full moon occurs every 27 and 28 days approximately. But the orbit of the moon around the Earth, and it's when it's perigee, the closest point to Earth, happens at the same time in the full moon, that's another cycle that there's a combination of cycles, kind of a counting calendar type of thing, combining two factors. And at that point, the full moon, when it's the closest, of course, looks bigger. And you'll see that. Imagine if we had a moon that came very close, and every now and then we'd have a moon that was just gigantic. And, of course, the end result, the other side of that, is at other times it would be very small. So anyway, remember that Monday night. Go out and check out the full moon. And just be happy that we're looking at things like full moons and not things like Planet X. Many times people ask me for an update on Planet X when I'm on radio shows. So really, there's no news. There's a lot of hype. I talked about this last week about the so-called Planet 9, but that's super far out in the solar system, and literally they have not discovered anything. So that's all just hype. I mean, that's fairy tale science at its best. And but anyway, there's no news upcoming on. There's no known, in spite of the fact that, you know, a lot of people run around YouTube all the time. And the 2012, I think, or was it 2013 recording where the CIA took my voice from a bunch of my programs around the year 2002 to 2004, cut and pasted them and make it sound like I'm saying, oh, there's this mini solar system, da-da-da. I'm not going to repeat it because somebody would try and clip it out of this show, but that there's some kind of Planet X issue, and there's not. And so anyway, that audio is going around again. People are posting it. People don't contact me. I just had a bout where I called people up through some other people and said, hey, take this down, and they took it down, and then by the time they took it down, there were 10 other copies of it someplace. So this is like the coffee cake that went around the world. And if you're not sure of this, from the Midwest, where I grew up, people give coffee cakes at Christmas time, and they're actually pretty good. They've got a lot of fruit and cherries and raisins and all kinds of fruit in them, and they come in a round can, and they're really pretty good. But a lot of people don't especially like them, so they save it for next year, and they give it away again. And then those people don't especially like it, so they save it and give it away the next year. So the joke is that the coffee cake gets given and given. It goes all the way around China and comes back to, and then on one Christmas, the person that originally gave the coffee cake gets it back. And so anyway, the term is the coffee cake that went around the world. And this has really happened, where people have given this coffee cake and it actually comes back to the same person that gave it in the first place. So it's kind of a joke. But anyway, the same principle applies. The point being is that YouTube has been notified to take this video down, that it's a cut and pasted hack job of my voice. It's not true information. They refuse to do it. And these people just keep, in fact, the last one, the guy made it sound like he was interviewing me and used this cut and paste thing. And he goes, I just got done talking to Jim McCanney. There's this hot breaking news. And then he plays this video or this audio of my voice making some kind of crazy Planet X claim that was, like I say, cut and pasted. I had a listener. When this first came out back in, 2012, 2013, sometime in that era, this listener went back and listened, because we knew it was from early in the, back in the 2000s someplace. So he listened to all my radio shows starting back then, and he found the radio shows that they located to pull the clips out of. And there was probably about 10 clips that they glued together to make it sound like I was making some kind of dire Planet X prediction of some kind. And that, like I say, is like the coffee cake that went around the world. It keeps rotating around YouTube. People keep reposting it. And they say, James McCanney, top authority on Planet X. And then this baloney comes out. And it's not me. I didn't ever said anything like this. But if you can take and cut and paste somebody's voice, then you can make them sound like they're saying almost anything. I hate to even bring this up on this show, but I mentioned it before, the enormous amount of information coming out, misinformation about going to Mars. I'll probably watch this a little bit unless I throw up. But the National Geographic special is coming out on going to Mars. And, of course, if you are aware at all, there's probably advertisement, vast amounts of advertisement going out along with this. But it's supposed to start this coming week also. I've looked at some of the preview information, the clips and the trailers and things like that. And this is Flash Gordon with, looks like a lot of it looks like animation that goes along with what Stanley Kubrick did back in the late, the 1960s. So selling animation of alleged trips to Mars, and these guys are walking around in their space suits. No radiation protection, no consciousness of radiation protection of any kind. And that was kind of the comical thing about Flash Gordon, because they were walking around in their little, you know, look like nylon space suits with no space helmet, nothing. And, of course, they would land in the and the smoke would come out of the rocket like cigarette smoke coming out of somebody smoking a cigarette. And they would land, and then the door would open on the set, and the people would walk out. I mean, what they're doing now is, you know, given the technology and animation technology, et cetera, it's pretty low quality, I would just say this, in the concepts. And what they're trying to promote here is not based on anything scientific at all. It's really disgusting, absolutely disgusting that they would spend this much time and effort. But see, this is to put it into the public's mind, and of course National Geographic, because they're who they are, will make a boatload of money off of this. But believe me, they're getting a lot of money under the table to promote this idea so that everybody's thinking, and the public is like this because they're unfortunately very ill-educated in terms of science. So you can have a guy walking around this little thin space suit with a little helmet on, like, oh, gee, yeah, they're walking around Mars, pretty normal. No, Mars has a tremendous radiation problem. And all I can tell you is that there's nothing real in this National Geographic special, nothing that would relate to any reality of going to Mars. As I said before, and I'll repeat it, if you can't go to the moon, you're certainly not going to be able to go to Mars. The moon is much closer. You don't have all of the issues of traveling that far in outer space. Mars has a thin atmosphere, which actually could present a problem. It's just thick enough that could cause some spacecraft coming in at high velocity to have some problems, whereas the moon does not. The whole issue of just landing this vehicle and carrying all the fuel along, this is a great example. The amount or the size of the landing vehicle that they have with all the people and everything, there's no room for fuel. And you would have to blast all of this fuel into outer space from Earth because NASA really doesn't have a way of generating fuel. I mean, it's a complicated process, liquid and hydrogen and liquid nitrogen. And I don't think they're going to be finding kerosene on Mars. There's no dinosaur bones up there. And, of course, that's a big myth. The one thing that I can guarantee you you're going to find on the moon, on Mars, and any planet like that in the solar system is going to be oil. You're going to find oil, the hydrocarbons. And that's because they didn't come from decaying fern forests. They came from cometary encounters. Okay, so anyway, all I'm going to say is I'm going to give an attempt to watch this first episode of the National Geographic special on Mars, but I doubt if I'll get very far into it without having to run to the bathroom first. Here's something a little bit exciting. Total eclipses of the sun are rather rare events.
But if you're planning next year's family vacation, you might want to consider August 21st as a date where you could be. This is a path that apparently runs from Oregon, slicing down through the central United States. And so the moon, of course, is going to block out completely the sun in those areas. And it's something that a lot of people get very excited about. So many times you have to travel to some South Pacific island or some remote place in Africa, but this one is coming right across the center of the United States, right in the middle of state fair time and vacations and hot dogs. And so it might be a good time to plan an outing. and August 21st, 2017. So put that on your calendar. That'll be very exciting. In fact, you know, maybe I'll do something myself. And let me see what day of the week that is. It turns out that that is a Monday. So maybe take a three-day weekend. And the all of the information on where this will take place will be, of course, on the internet. So go check that out. There'll be many places, but very interesting. And read up also on some of the major effects. And people get certain feelings when they also when they see this. It's like electrical or something, you know, something very significant happens to people. They see visual things. There's various visual events that occur with the complete blockage of the sunlight. And as it starts to get dark and as it goes to totality, what is called totality, the complete blockage of the sun, there are ringed effects. You can see the solar corona. Oh, it's just a fabulous experience. So I encourage everybody to consider that. Start planning so that you are in attendance next year in the good old United States. I should also mention that this is a timed event. So that if you're, for example, in Oregon or South Carolina, it's going to happen at a different time because this is moving across, literally moving across the country. As the Earth spins and the moon itself is moving. So at any rate, you want to make sure that you know where you're going to be, but also the time in that location when this when totality occurs. So a few things to check up. And like I say, read about all the various effects that people see and feel and et cetera when they're at these events. And of course, a lot of times you're with a lot of other people there, and there's a you know, like a football game or a baseball game, a lot of excitement because of the crowds that are there. So anyway, once again, August 21st, 2017, total eclipse of the sun, United States. Okay, the last few minutes here of the show, I got about 15 minutes to go. I'm going to talk about Goddard and the early rocketry. This is kind of an interesting topic, and kids always get very excited about rockets. And they're available. You can buy these at hobby stores, but typically they're solid fuel. Liquid fuel is a bit more complicated, but Goddard was the first person to put together the concepts, ended up with over 200 patents, somewhat the Tesla of rocketry. At the time, that was the only method of going into outer space. What I realized in early in my studies in physics is it's commonly called the rocket problem. If you have a payload, okay, so the whole purpose of shooting this rocket off is to get something up in the air or into outer space, into orbit. And so imagine that you have a payload of 2,000 pounds. And you want to add 1 pound extra. Okay, so now, of course, with that extra pound, you're not going to be able to get into orbit. And so you have to add more fuel. But to add more fuel, you need to add more fuel to lift the fuel because the fuel becomes a part of the payload in a sense. And so this becomes an exponential problem, and there's a limit. There's a physical limit to how much you can practically get into outer space in a, on a rocket. Now, the with the advent of aircraft and the understanding of airfoils, let me just give you, first of all, a basic example here. And why the industry has refused to go this way is beyond me. Bert Rutan does it very successfully. It's like child's play to take an aircraft that comes off of a runway with the lift of aerodynamic wings and get up to 40, 50,000 feet. And then instead of using brute force with basically a rocket, which just lifts itself off the ground,
The lift is provided by the wings. It's a much more intelligent way to get up to that altitude. If you take the Saturn V rocket, for example, the total liftoff weight was around 6.5 million pounds. The low Earth orbit capacity was around 300,000 pounds, and the payload, which actually was able to get off and go towards the moon, was about 100,000 pounds. And so two-thirds of the weight, once it got into orbit, two-thirds of the weight was in fuel. And the ratio between the liftoff weight and the amount of pounds, the weight that actually could go into a lunar trajectory, was around 65 to 1. So there were 65 pounds of original rocket weight to 1 pound of payload that actually was usable once it got out into outer space. So this is the rocket problem. And so as you add more weight to the payload, you have to add more. That ratio doesn't hold true as you get to bigger and bigger payloads. So smaller rockets can carry proportionately larger payloads is what this is saying for the weight of the... But then again, a smaller rocket is not going to get you into orbit. So it's a complicated issue designing a rocket. There's a lot of factors designing a rocket that can get into outer space and do useful work. But here's a little fun fact that a 747 jet can take 3 times that weight. In other words, it can take up to 1 million pounds up to 50,000 feet. And needless to say, the amount of fuel that it takes a 747 jet to do that is far less than the amount of fuel in the Saturn V rocket, which burns the majority of that fuel up by the time it gets up to 50,000 feet. The trajectory of a rocket, it moves relatively slowly for that first 50,000 feet. That's about 7 miles up, and that's where the air gets thin enough that it can pick up speed without losing a lot of velocity to, or a lot of energy to air resistance. The wind resistance or the air resistance factor goes up as the velocity squared and also depends on the air pressure, the density of the air. So as you get up higher, you don't want to go fast with a rocket at low altitude because you're going to just burn up a lot of energy just pushing it through the air. So the whole purpose of the Saturn V rocket was to go slow up to around 50,000 feet. Then you are out of the atmosphere. And remember that the highest mountain on Earth might be pushing around 20,000 feet, or the average mountain that someone would climb, just say an average is 20,000 feet. And so but getting up to 50,000 feet, the air is really thin. But the 747 jet can do it with an extremely small amount of fuel and can carry 3 times the payload, nearly 1 million pounds fully loaded, anywhere from 750,000 pounds to 1 million pounds is the takeoff weight of a 747 jet. So here's the issue. Why wouldn't NASA go with a launch system that could take off a runway, fly up to 50,000 feet, drop a payload of double what it could have done with the Saturn V rocket that would then take off and go into outer space. And literally, you could have much more capacity. It would be far cheaper to just have a 747-style airplane that got up to 50,000 feet, opens up the bay doors, drops the payload out, and then lifts away as this payload takes off and zooms up. And that even the payload could use aerodynamic lift to get a good ways up through the atmosphere with aerodynamic lift. So you would reduce the amount of fuel consumed. The ease of which this could be done is phenomenal. But going back to Goddard, back in his day, he was, remember that Goddard was doing the bulk of his really good work in the 1930s. He went out to New Mexico, where he didn't happen to burn down the neighbor's barnyard and barn, etc. He was having problems. I think he was up in Massachusetts originally, but went out to the Southwest, wide open spaces where he could work and nobody out there to bother him at all. But even at that early point in time, it should have been clear to any good engineer that the lift capabilities of wings and the ability to get up. Now, let's also mention this, that the highest altitude that Goddard got to in his lifetime was around, I think, 8,000 feet, which is not very high. It's not very high at all. And so compare that to the airplanes of the time. The airplanes could get to easily to that height and more back in those days. They had planes that were, you know, open cockpit that easily could get up to those altitudes, especially in the area, the post-world, the pre-World War II era of Europe and the United States and some of the other countries that were involved in aviation. So it should have been, in my way of thinking, maybe I'm, you know, tell me if I'm wrong. I've been right on a few things in my life. Wouldn't it have been obvious right from the very beginning that runway to launch to a secondary launch at about 50,000 feet or the highest altitude you can get to, maybe 60, 70,000 feet, with some specially designed aircraft with a variable wing design that could take you up that far, and then at very high velocity, the payload would go out, use wings also, aerodynamic lift, and reduce drastically the complexity. And then this launch craft comes back, lands on a runway, you load in another payload, it goes up there, and all of this is reusable. In the case of the Saturn V, none of it was reusable, which brings us up to the modern era after the space shuttle, which was basically, they called it the flying brick. The space shuttle, the entire spacecraft was payload. So you had this enormously big spacecraft, and many times the payload that they wanted to get into outer space was relatively small. And so the idea of having an entire spacecraft going up and then coming back, which was very heavy, really didn't make a lot of sense. And so the idea of a space shuttle, the idea of a vehicle that can go into outer space and then fly back down and land is very good, but the space shuttle itself was really too heavy. And one of the problems with a heavy vehicle like that is when it comes into the atmosphere, all that kinetic energy has to be dissipated by atmospheric drag and heating. And so thus the space shuttle had a tremendous amount of heat that was generated as it came back into the atmosphere, which of course caused some problems. I remember the first space shuttle that came in landed, it was missing like many of the tiles off the bottom, these heat shield tiles that are glued on. And by the way, that's where super glue came from. The ability to glue those tiles onto the space shuttle. So anyway, back to Goddard. At the time, using rocketry, and you know, you have to laud the guy for doing this on his own. He did get some funding, and from was it Carnegie or I forget who exactly was giving him money to develop his rocketry, but this was the basis for modern rocketry that got us into, you know, the space age, the intercontinental ballistic missile stage, the Saturn V in the alleged Apollo moon program, etc. And so the Saturn V moon rocket was truly an incredible machine. But why now would Elon Musk and Bezos and all these other people want to go with rocketry as a way to go into outer space when Bert Rutan has clearly showed that the way to do this, and Elon Musk is having tremendous, he's having success landing a rocket on a launch pad. But part of this also is that the issue that Mars does not have a thick atmosphere. And so trying to come in and take off with a vehicle on Mars with aerodynamics is really not that plausible unless you get up to very high velocities. Okay, so then you run into a few other problems like heating because you're going so fast. You're not getting very much lift for the velocity. So I can understand that. If you want to go to Mars, then you're probably going to have retro rockets to slow you down. But still, the majority of space traffic that we should be doing, the actual number of space launches for the United States throughout its entire history is very, very small. And now we just basically hardly have any activity at all. Okay, so anyway, it's a somewhat of a conversation I'm having with myself here, dealing with rocketry and what we should be doing with a space program. In short, what we should be doing with a space program is a runway to intermediate drop and carry into outer space with reusable vehicles. This is why people like Chuck Yeager back in the 1950s were flying the X-planes, basically the X-plane series, which were rocket planes. And they would fly them out of very high velocities in the atmosphere. And when the Apollo program came about and the Gemini program, they quit because they wanted to fly. These were pilots. They didn't want to sit in a space capsule strapped in like a monkey that couldn't do anything. Okay, so anyway, we're running out of time with this show. Had kind of a collage of topics to talk about. Remember that my webpage red letter sale is still on. During the last few weeks of the election process, everybody's sales went down, including mine. And that's understandable. People are busy. They're concentrating. They're worried. Their future, many issues. But that's over now. So hopefully people will get back to looking at the holidays coming up. If you want somebody to give you a gift, give them my webpage address, or if you're giving somebody a gift, you can put in someone else's address in the send to, and we'll ship it to them. Remember that my water filter elements are they do not have any add-ons required. There's no priming involved. They are the double wide imperials are there. They're all in one filters. And also my books, etc., are there. Remember that when I sell a water filter, I give 4 water filter elements, not 2 like other people with other brands of water filters. And that saves you a lot of money. At any rate, this is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And remember my paid cast. This week's paid cast topic is dealing with Baal worship in Washington, D.C. and the New York financial community. Very interesting topic. So go sign up for that, the subscription on my webpage, jmccsci.com. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.